everything about them felt bigger than everything that was happening. It felt like, even dead presidents, I don't know, just seeing them, and it just felt like
more effort,
like a movie we haven't seen,
right?
And it felt authentic. Yeah. They didn't feel freshmen, even when they were freshmen.
Right.
You know what I mean? It felt like you wanted to know. They had some secrets we didn't know about, even though we've been in the game a little bit already, that they had some answers that we didn't know.
That is me and Saif's old colleague, Angie Martinez. You may have heard of her.
Yeah.
She was everything at Hot 97 in the heyday of hip hop.
Yeah, Angie's like a sister to me, and I would say like an enemy to Rosenberg. She doesn't like you.
That's correct.
Well, when do you remember him going from popping to being the man? Like, he became Jay-Z for real.
It's probably harder for you to think about it because you've always been at a very baseline level with him. But you can see those moments when you're like, holy shit. Like, this guy is my friend and he's now hanging with so-and-so or doing this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that always connects when you start seeing like super famous people, like, their fans too. I don't know. I feel like it was a slow progression too. I don't know. I think Dame was really good at marketing in a way that it forced you to feel outside, like them doing those parties in the Hamptons and then seeing models in their videos and showing them overseas. And
yeah,
he tried to really paint this picture of this, you know, Pamela Anderson was in one of the videos. I'm not saying that was the moment. I'm just saying when I started seeing people like that,
yeah,
wanting to be down, you really start being like, oh, wow, this is...
Yeah, this is getting bigger than
this
just...
This is big.
New York hip hop, like...
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome to One Ep. I'm Peter Rosenberg.
And my name is Cypher Sounds.
And what is One Ep?
One Ep is a conglomeration of two folks.
All right, it's a hip-hop podcast. You're making it too complicated.
No.
I can already tell.
I was going to say that.
Hip-hop podcast.
Yeah, but we don't do hip-hop. We talk about hip-hop.
People know what a podcast is.
Right.
All right, so when we left off last time, it's the mid-90s, you know? Yep. Jay-Z he's making a name for himself, right?
Of course.
He did the tour with Big Daddy Kane.
Yep.
He's not just Jazzo's little friend anymore.
No, he's making noise.
That's right. He's working on his own music now. He's playing clubs in New York. He's making connections. He's getting hooked up. He's starting to know people.
He's also taking music more seriously with the urging of people like the one and only Clark Kent. Like, you got to understand who Clark Kent was in the industry at that time in the early and mid-90s. You know what I'm saying? Clark Kent is a very famous DJ. He used to DJ for Dana Dane. He's from Brooklyn, and he was the club king. He did all the big clubs in New York City. He became an A&R for a couple different labels. He was a producer. He was basically a major player, and he starts connecting Jay-Z to other artists that he also worked with. For example, Notorious B.I.G. Smalls.
Never heard of him. But Clark also, can I just say, side note, I think he's one of the coolest looking dudes in hip hop. Is that weird?
No.
He just looks cool.
He definitely has a whole nother life of being like this sneaker connoisseur.
Yeah, he is. He's a cool ass dude. And he is the guy who ends up, you know, really telling Biggie about how dope Jay-Z is. Mm-hmm. Now, around this same time, Jay-Z also links up with this brash, loud, arrogant, smart dude.
Oh, you were around back then?
No, but I know, dude.
No, I'm saying... I thought you were saying he was introducing him to you.
Oh, no. I'm talking about Damon Dash.
Dame Dash, yes, from Harlem.
All right, so you have Jay-Z, you have Dame Dash, and then you have another cat, a hustler from Harlem named Kareem Biggs Burke. Mm. They all come together and form what we know as Rockefeller Records.
So the first time I knew of Jay-Z was Battle of the Beats. I had this feature called Battle of the Beats. I used to pit one song against the other. And he had, oh my God, what was the flip side of
Get with that.
Now, what was that song going up against in the battle?
I believe it was against Ill & Out Scratch. Oh. And I believe in Ill & Out Scratch at that time was a big deal.
Don't
right?
say it was against Where My Homies.
No, it was the one after that.
I'll Take Her.
I'll take her.
Okay.
And
because if it was against where my homies, sorry, Hov.
Because they were already ill and out scratched. They were a name. And normally in Battle of the Beats, even though I like to think people have a good ear, usually who's the most famous person would win sometimes. Right. So it was ill and out scratched against this guy named Jay-Z from Brooklyn that nobody knew of yet. And the numbers were crazy. Like, Jay blew it out the water.
Really?
And so I remember, like, poking around, like, who's Jay-Z? Like, who is this guy?
Right.
And I think it was so Jay won, like, four nights in a row. Uh-huh. And I think on the fourth or fifth night, because we used to retire them after the fifth night, Jay and Dame showed up at the radio station in the buggy-eyed Rockefeller Benz. People weren't wrapping cars back then, you know what I mean? So they had a buggy-eyed Benz, and it was wrapped with all these Rockefeller logos, and they had like the back rigged, it was like the trunk, and they had it rigged to show videos. So they were like, hey, how you doing? I'm Dame, I'm Jay, whatever. I was like, oh yeah, congratulations.
They were waiting outside for you?
Outside the radio
station.
When
you left or when you came in?
When I left.
Okay.
And, you know, Dame was the talker, and Jay was kind of like, cool, nice to meet you, whatever. And Dame was like, yo, we got to show you the video. So he pops the trunk and the trunk opens and there's like a video screen. And I'm hilarious. Like, people weren't doing shit like, can I curse on you?
Yeah.
People weren't doing shit like that.
No, this is a clean Amish podcast.
Well, the last one you did was Amish. So I thought.
By the way, I like that they went with the buggy eye Benz, which is so expensive and they wanted classy, but they also wrapped it and had videos playing on it.
In the back.
It's like so.
Well, because it was like their promotional van.
Right. So it was a mix of like, we're going to fly in classy. But
isn't that really what they built their whole label and existence on? Like, like upscale, but then also
so hip hop
and relatable, flashy, right? So anyway, so he played it. I was like, oh, first of all, I was like, who the hell are these two guys? Yeah. They gave me a bottle of champagne. They did that, thank me. I was like, all right, well, but I was impressed by their presentation, and you could tell that they were not some regular like up and coming rappers. Yeah. Like, it felt different. You know,
no idea who these guys were beforehand.
Nothing, no.
Nothing, okay.
No.
All right, now, Saif, let's talk about how important Hot 97 was as an outlet in hip-hop at this time.
Yeah, Hot 97 was obviously the place I spent 17 years of my life, and now I'm just disgraced radio personality. But
sad.
The term hip-hop radio, when you hear that term, a hip-hop radio station, Hot 97 started that.
Some people say it was KMEL.
Mm.
Yeah, I'll go with Hot.
Mm.
And when it came to New York, I mean, Hot 97 was everything. I'm talking about, there was no, I know this is trite to say, but it's true. There wasn't YouTube. There weren't blogs. There wasn't, you know, people tweeting about what new music there was.
Yeah.
There was Hot 97. There was driving around at night, listening to Funk Flex play these records.
Yep.
Listening to Angie Martinez do interviews in the afternoons.
Yep.
This is what hip-hop sounded like, Hot 97.
And it was authentic, too. Yeah, that's the thing about Hot 97. Like, they didn't just grab any old jocks from some other kind of format station and then just make it a hip-hop station. Like, the people on Hot 97 were of the culture. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, they didn't just go out and get some random, you know, hip-hop-loving white boys from the suburbs of Maryland.
Not yet.
And just throw them on the air.
Yeah,
no. I mean, if you do that, once you do that, that's death.
We had a good run.
We did. Can you give us a little bit about what the general radio scene in New York was at the time? I obviously know this. We obviously know this. But how important radio was at that point to music in New York culturally?
That was it, especially for interviews. Like, so now you're starting to hear artists talk on the radio, which now seems like no big deal because they're everywhere. But if you were a fan of like Group Home or like, you know, any other of the earlier groups, they weren't getting press where you get to see them talk and get to know who they were. This was it. We were it. Yeah. And like, so any of the up and coming hip, you know, and the new hip hop artists, this was the house for it. And so, it became very, you know, just it was like a cultural moment and spot. And it was nobody else doing that. I mean, MTV was doing like they were covering some rap stories. And
if they made you MTV Raps.
Raw MTV Raps, right. But that was, you know, you would see Naughty by Nature. And those you weren't going to see some of the more like underground or new artists there right away. And, you know, so that it was that. It was like the go-to place if you were a hip-hop fan.
All right, so you got to look at the history of the whole situation. At this point, Jay-Z is still basically an underground rapper. He's gaining a lot of traction. He's making a lot of noise. He's in the hip-hop world. But despite all that popularity, he still couldn't get a record deal. That is something you need to understand. Jay-Z, who we now know is the greatest, could not get a record deal.
Yeah, and that sort of remained part of his story for a very long time. And I think it also gave him a chip on his shoulder that he held on to for a very long time. So he's working. He starts to mature. He gets a more laid-back style. I don't know why. If it's maybe he just got bored of the fast rapping or he wanted to do something that was a little more accessible. But if you listen to his first single, his first official single, In My Lifetime,
yeah,
you can hear how he doesn't try to squeeze in as many words as he used to. So he's developing as an artist, okay? But he was not a great performer yet. And Saif, I remember seeing him a couple years after this time.
Yeah.
He still wasn't a great performer at that time. Now, you may remember the legendary DJ Scratch from the last episode. Well, turns out Scratch is not just a great DJ. He's like a hip-hop performance guru as well, Saif.
I saw EPMD perform before I got down with them. I'm like, yo, they're trash on stage. Like, they just stood there. They were nervous, you know what I'm saying? Young kids, teenagers, they literally stood next to each other and didn't move. And the crowd hated that shit. It was like, yo, they're whack.
By the way, Hove was not different at the very beginning.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's what I was getting to. So, like, Jay wasn't a good performer either. You know, Jay's laid back. He a laid back dude, so he's not going to move too much. You know what I mean? But I'm like, yo, you got to, when you're on stage, you have to enjoy your music. Because if you don't look like you're enjoying your music, the crowd is not going to enjoy you.
So despite Jay's undeniable talent, there were still some barriers to making his hobby profitable. Now, I really want to stress how important this moment was. At the time, all we knew was be a rapper, get a record deal, sign to a major label, and then get, you know, try to become a star. But he wasn't getting the deal. So this is where they try to translate the street smarts and the distribution skills they had from the streets into the capitalist enterprise of the record industry. This is the moment. This is the moment where a hustler became a businessman.
So I think Dame Dash was managing Original Flavor at the time.
That's Austin Williams, a writer for Complex.
Dame eventually got connected to Jay-Z. And Biggs actually tells a funny story where he wasn't really impressed with Jay-Z's rapping at first. So it was that sort of thing where someone's like, yo, my man can rap, but you should meet him. And then they meet, and then they don't hit it off right away. He wasn't really impressed with the double-time, fast-rapping Jay-Z. And he tells a story about he wasn't really sold on Jay-Z as a rapper until In My Lifetime.
All right, so we just mentioned that Jay had flipped up his flow and done it a little bit differently on the record In My Lifetime. Mm-hmm. Well, he dropped In My Lifetime in 1995 on Payday Records, okay?
On vinyl?
That's right, a vinyl record 12-inch single.
Wow.
That's right. It was In My Lifetime Remix, and Can't Get With That was on the B-side. And they were doing everything they could to get Jay-Z's name out there, sending people bottles of champagne.
Yeah.
Rolling up on Angie Martinez. Here's Jay-Z talking to us back in 2011 about all the different methods they used to get DJ's attention. Can you tell me a little about the idea? I love this. I wasn't DJing yet, but everyone told me about the promo idea that you and Dame had for In My Lifetime. Do you remember sending out the wax for In My Lifetime?
Yeah.
Tell people about
that. You mean
that.
Talking about with the champagne
yes.
and all that?
Yeah.
My cousin Bihai, he really hates this to this day.
Why?
He hates all DJs because of this. Because he reduced himself in his mind to, you know, this is a Brooklyn you know, guy who's been in the street.
The pride is crazy.
He's making baskets, putting champagne and confetti party favors. Yeah, like he's gonna kill me for this. And lining the bottom of the basket with like that Easter stuff, you know that. You know that green stuff?
The
I don't even know what
paper,
you call
like,
it. No,
the grass,
like the fake grass.
Yeah. He's lining it, and you know we're making big baskets, and we're taking it to the radio station, and you know he's standing out there at 4 a.m. to catch Flex
with a basket,
and Flex is just walking by. Yeah, homie. Yeah. I get back to you.
And what did he throw? Threw in there two copies of the vinyl, a bottle of Dom P.
Yeah, it was Moet.
Oh, Moet. Right. Bottle of Moet. I'm sorry. Yeah, because you had the bottle on the thing.
Yeah.
Bottle of Moet and then some party favors, maybe some cheese.
Yeah, cheese and grapes and chocolate.
Did it really work?
It didn't really work.
Nah, did the record get any love?
Like, no.
Because I was just playing it on my nerd shit.
It didn't really work.
In my lifetime?
No, man.
Now, the relationship with Dame Dash is interesting. Jay's from Brooklyn, all right? He has a certain way of operating. Dame Dash is classic Harlem, but they came together and it made sense as a team. And you keep saying they, so to emphasize, you really did think of Jay-Z and his partner Dame Dash as a team. It was the two
100%.
Of them.
It was Jay and Dame. Yes, it was Jay. I didn't know Biggs that well back then because Biggs was very quiet. He was like behind the scenes a lot. Jay was the artist and Dame was on the street. Dame was running around doing all the work and letting people know what it was and fighting the fights. And
Did that allow Jay to be the cool guy that he was too?
100%. There's no way you can fight so hard. Like he was a lunatic sometimes, Dame. And I mean that, you know, in the nicest way. Because you needed to be to a certain extent. And Jay, even though he was super smart, you know, super smart, super, I don't know, just everything was on purpose. Mm-hmm. There had to be a certain amount of like, just obnoxiousness or arrogance to push them past a certain moment.
Yeah.
I don't know that. I mean, as talented, as incredible as Jay is, I think, of course, he would have found his way no matter what. I think his story would have been very different without Dame.
Now, Jay-Z releases Dead Presidents in 1996, but the B-side of that record was a song with Foxy Brown called Ain't No N. Ain't No Sample, 7 Minutes of Funk by the Hold Darn Family, right, Syfe?
Yes, that's correct.
And it's an interesting record because Foxy was scorching hot at this time.
Yeah.
I mean, she was hot, popping.
She was on fire.
And I think she's like 16 or 17 years old. She absolutely shows what she's all about on this song. What up, boo? Just keep me laced in the
illest snakes. You got Foxy Brown. You got Jay-Z. They're both up-and-coming artists. So the collab is basically mutually beneficial for both of them.
So you have these records that are helping him get more visibility.
Mm-hmm.
He's starting to blow.
Yeah.
Now, he also has a developing relationship with Biggie.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a minute. But when Reasonable Doubt drops in 1996, it puts Jay-Z officially on the map.
Look, not just in New York. He's gaining attention of the media. This album is basically traveling all around the country.
We talked to Kim Osorio and Dayton Thomas, two hip-hop journalists who covered Jay for a long time.
What do you mean covered him? What do you mean covered
him? It's like...
What do you mean? Like,
it means
like they put blankets on them?
I was working at a company called Muse. It was a music software database that used to put the kiosk in the record stores. So I was entering all of the data from all of the CD. From every CD that's come out in like the 90s, I entered the data.
By hand?
By hand.
Oh my God. Real time.
It's what gives me a lot of my knowledge. I can tell you like, oh yeah, that was recorded at Chung King Studios.
Hey, this is Kim Osorio, hip-hop journalist, editor, and now executive producer of Love and Hip Hop New York.
Yeah, Kim Osorio used to work for The Source, Vibe, XXL.
She didn't work. She was editor-in-chief.
But these are called magazines.
What's that?
This is the internet before the internet. This is when you could hold the internet and flip through the pages.
So we talked about Reasonable Doubt
mm-hmm.
and how it was received. Let's start there. How did you personally receive Reasonable Doubt and how big a deal did Reasonable Doubt become amongst the hip hop journalist crowd?
So anyway, I got Reasonable Doubt. It was an advance copy and I listened to it and no one really heard of Jay-Z. back then. And I just remember being blown away lyrically. I love that type of hip hop. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I started to, you know, do my research. He actually had this underground record. It was a B-side, right?
In My Lifetime?
I can't get with that.
Right. So he had this record. And when I heard his flow on that record, that's when I was really like, who is this guy?
Right.
You know, and then the album, The Advance, came not too long after that, I think. So, you know, it was different. It was unique. He had his own flow. It was very Brooklyn. And I think it was the way that Jay-Z put words together that really impressed me.
Daytuan, intern to Vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you became a writer for XXL in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. went all the way to editor-in-chief,
mm-hmm.
then worked for Global Grind.
Yep, did that with Russell for a bit.
And now editor-in-chief of Vibe.
Yeah, I started King magazine too, and the Freshman List.
You started
list.
King too?
Yeah.
And you started the Freshman List of XXL. Yeah. When did you realize Jay-Z is not just a dude who put out a nice single and a nice album? Jay-Z's like, this guy's for
a
real.
Guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was before Reasonable Doubt for me.
Really?
Yeah.
Where are you from, Daytuan?
I'm from Brooklyn. Breevoy Projects. And
got it. We got it.
Yeah, so there it is.
All right. What about, pretend you weren't from Brooklyn.
When was the first? I would have to say, like, when, I don't know, Brooklyn's Finest was a big deal. Yeah. To be able to get Jay and Big on the same record.
Yeah.
Because then that was the first time you were like, okay, here go the Titans.
Called Brooklyn's it's Finest.
Like, come on, man.
You
like,
set the bar high.
You set the bar super high. Yeah. And then in my mind, you know, of course we're not thinking that Big is going to, you know, what end up happening to Big.
Yeah.
You don't think of that. You're like, how is this going to work? Because we never had Big Daddy Kane and somebody like with Kane that can go back and forth like that, you know, for that same era. I was just looking forward to seeing that happen.
Yeah, that would have been sick.
I mean, you had Kane and G-Rap on the
Symphony
together.
But that's Queens, though. That's Queens.
Right.
I'm saying like two Brooklyn dudes going, it's always Brooklyn versus Queens, like Queens versus Bronx, Brooklyn. Like, it was like, this would be the first time.
That's a good point.
Yeah, man.
He emerged while Biggie existed.
Yes. Yes.
Everyone else after, you did not have to deal with the shadow that Biggie had cast in the moment.
Right.
But Reasonable Doubt made its noise and all that happened while 96. Biggie's sitting right there.
96. I mean, yeah, imagine Biggie sitting listening to Reasonable Doubt. Like, that happened.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, think about it. That's how the Brooklyn's Finest shit came together. Clark is like, he keeps talking about Jay.
Right.
I think it was more so the influence of Clark rather than the people being behind Jay.
Yeah.
I think Big really respected Clark's opinion.
Yeah,
if you
that.
Were from Brooklyn at that time, and I'm going to be real with y'all, before I even got in the game, I remember seeing Clark Kent cross the street, and I just ran up on him like, yo, man, everything you did with Dana Dane was so ill. And he was looking at me like, what the fuck you know that shit from?
By the way, for those listening, you can't see Daytuan. He's somewhere between the age of 36 and 59.
easily. And it was just bugged out that Big held him in such high regard.
Yeah.
You know, especially when Clark is that guy.
Yeah.
But the rest of the industry doesn't necessarily know that. He knew who to listen to.
The appearance of Biggie on Brooklyn's Finest was a huge stamp of approval.
That was a big moment.
Biggie was... He's one of the biggest rappers in the world at the time. He's the biggest star in Brooklyn, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get together on Brooklyn's Finest, and it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Now...
It was the early version of two verbal assassins going at each other. And it wasn't just a verse, a hook, and then a verse from someone else. They were all intertwined in the song.
Yeah, no, they go back and forth. It's amazing. Now, Clark Kent, who we've talked about many times, he really believed in Jay-Z. And he was actually instrumental in getting the two to collaborate. Clark actually told us an incredible story about getting Jay-Z and Biggie together when we had him on 1UP a few years ago. What's one thing you could tell us about Biggie before you go? That maybe you've never shared before, or just something.
We were on tour.
Jim.
We were on tour. And I'm consistently playing Jay for him. And he's like, all right. He's good.
For Big.
Yeah. But, you know, he's not conceding. You know what I'm saying? He's like, yeah, all right, Clark, he's good. And then Un would call him and be like, yo, this that president shit is crazy, Big. He listened to it. Yo, man, yo, your man's nice. And we got to that. But we didn't get to he's the illest, right? Now, you're riding around with the dude that you feel is one of the best you'll ever hear, telling him
about another one.
My dude is the illest, respectfully. But he's my guy. So what you believe is going to be what you believe. But now the whole Junior Mafia are like, oh, we want to kill Clark.
And why? Because like, you're forcing. Because you're forcing.
No, because I'm trying to make them understand. Yeah, I know he's nice, but my man is. And they're all going, "Yo, what kind of disrespectful shit are you on?" So cool. We're on our way back to New York, and Big has to go to the studio, and he says, "Yo, I'm going to go do a second verse on Who Shot Ya. When I come back, you're going to say I'm the best." Right.
Shit.
So he goes, "If who, for people who don't know Who Shot Ya, that first verse was always there.
Yeah,
it was on a record with Keith Murray, and it was on Mary J. Blige's interlude, but you didn't get to hear Big's verse. So that verse,
hey, you have the Keith Murray version?
Hmm?
You have the Keith Murray version?
Kinda.
Can we have it? I just want it for my collection. I won't play it.
Wow, that's going to find that. But regardless, right, so we go back, like 2 days later, we're back, and we're at the airport, and we're about to leave, and he goes, yo, yo, nah, 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 nah. We ain't getting on the plane. I'm like, what the fuck? He's like, I gotta play this for you. They bring out the radio and he plays Who Shot Ya. I'm like, yeah, I know that. He goes, no. You gonna say I'm the hardest rapper out. I said, no, you're definitely, pause, the hardest rapper out. He's like, nah, but you're gonna say I'm iller than your man. And I was like, dog, I give you that you're like amazing to me.
But you could not concede that he was better than Jay.
But then he's like, listen to this. And he plays Who Shot Ya from beginning to end.
His friend versus his son. You gotta see where it's at. Jay's his friend, Big's his son. See what I'm saying?
But I'm listening to it and I'm just like, fuck, he really meant that shit, yo. You know what I'm saying? So I'm telling him, I was like, yo, you know what? And that's when I figured out rapper MC. Like, remember how I tried to explain to you the difference between rapper and MC? That day is when I figured it out. I said, yo, for real, you said your rhymes better than anybody I've ever heard say their rhymes. And he was like, the fuck are you talking about? So I'm the best. I was like, no, you're the best rapper I've ever heard. And he was like, so what does that make your man? I said, my man's the best MC I've ever heard. He was like, what the fuck is the difference?
See, but you gotta...
No, no, but like Junior Mafia, we're all in an airport and now shit is heated. These dudes are mad. They're like, what the fuck, man? Fuck this nigga, man. Leave this nigga home. Like, now I can't go on the road because they're like, fuck him. And I was like, no. You say your rhymes better than anyone I've ever heard. He says the best rhymes I've ever heard. And he was like, but am I the hardest? And I was like, absolutely.
You got it.
So
you got it.
Then I walked away from it. And then I was like, okay, yeah, you can get on the plane now.
The respect was definitely mutual between Jay and Biggie.
Here's a little more from our Jay-Z interview from 2011.
There's a lot made of your relationship with Big and like the hip hop history. It's always, you guys are associated. You quote him all the time. What was the actual relationship like with you? I always question, were they actually really tight? Were they kind of just like guys who were worked in the, you know, were both rhyming?
No.
What was the relationship
after with Brooklyn's Finest? We went to see Bernie Mac. And from that day, I don't think there was a day that passed that we didn't speak. If we didn't go out to eat, we spoke on the phone.
Oh, you guys really? Were that tight after Brooklyn's Finest?
Yeah, yeah.
But up until then...
If you look at his last interview on BET, he's a shout out my daughter. You could tell, right? Playboy Jay-Z, Jigga, it's the last thing he says. You know, he said about four names. Yeah, we're pretty tight.
Just got close.
Day.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Biggie passes away in 1997, which was just, as everyone knows, a huge loss for hip-hop. He's one of the biggest. You literally cannot overstate how big a loss it was. It just absolutely took over the entire music industry. He was one of the most promising voices in hip hop. And of course, he also leaves a really big space and void in the New York hip hop scene.
That is a weird thing right there, because Biggie is a worldwide phenomenon, superstar, not superstar as we know today what he should have been, but like he was still the biggest rapper in the game. But there's something about being from New York and he was the king, and now the king is gone. And we didn't even know we needed a king until we had one, and then he was taken away from us. So now what? So now who's king?
It was a night. And I also remember, and this is not in order, but I do remember seeing Jay he had a performance scheduled, and it was right after Biggie died, and it was in a club downtown. And I remember he had to show up, And I remember there was members of Junior Mafia there that night, but I just remember looking at him on stage, like he looked so miserable. I mean, we all did. But him having to still perform, he just looked like broken. Mm. You know what I mean?
So, Saif, would you say Jay-Z almost like stepped into the role of King of New York? It was almost like, who is going to be the voice, the face of New York? And Jay-Z became that guy.
I mean, what are we talking about? This is over 20 years ago, right? So now, obviously, we know now that he did step into that role. But at the time, it wasn't clear. You know, the winner writes the history books, right? So he was in the running because Jay-Z was closest to Biggie. It was sometimes assumed, but then other people would get upset that it was assumed. It was like, no. He doesn't just get that. Not just because he's Biggie's friend and he's from Brooklyn.
Although it's interesting because when you hear Jay-Z tell us like he did about just how close they were when Biggie passed, it does make it make even more sense. Like, yes, he did it because he was an incredible artist and his music blew up. But when you think about it, it does make sense that like the guy who was that close to Biggie at the time of his passing would sort of
like
get that honor.
You think like he had the inside secrets in order to take it over? You know what I mean?
Not even just like the natural and true respect based not only on his ability, but of the real genuine affection that Biggie had for him.
Yeah, but what does that matter if the king has affection for you? That doesn't make the next king.
Yeah, but it does if you're also maybe the nicest in the game.
That's combination. The argument. That's the argument. Was he the nicest in the game?
So after Reasonable Doubt, Rockefeller starts having more leverage to negotiate Jay into a deal,
mm-hmm.
Because the success of the first album and mm-hmm. the singles, etc. And that's exactly what happens with Def Jam Records.
Yeah.
Def Jam ends up acquiring half of Rockefeller and becomes the distributor.
Right, but that's like, you had your shot. You could have got me dirt cheap. Now you got to pay. Now you need to pay for this. And Def Jam paid.
They did. They sure did. What did he do after the success of that record and the album? What steps did you see getting taken for him to go from this guy who dropped a great album to getting to being the star that he was when Volume 1 comes out and starts to blow up?
Well, I think what Rockefeller did just as a team was they set the tone for where the industry was going, right? These boutique, smaller labels that did their own thing. The interesting thing when you hear the story is that nobody wanted to sign him, right? We took him everywhere. No one wanted to sign, so we decided to put it out ourselves, right? And therein sort of birthed like this, along with other labels, but birthed this hip-hop entrepreneurialism, if I can say the word, that really grew and changed the way that we consumed music, right? They changed the mold of what the industry was back then. It was like twofold, right? Yes, there was the artistry. He was, you know, well-respected and just sort of looked at as someone who was authentic in what he was talking about. Because, I mean, come on, we was talking about dealing drugs, right? And the streets. But on the other hand, they knew how to, I was going to say move weight, right?
Mm-hmm. You can say that.
I can't say that.
I don't know how much weight it
was.
Yeah,
well, I guess. Yeah. So they knew the hustle and they applied that hustle to the industry. And I think they were growing not just, and Jay-Z in particular was growing not just as an artist, but as an entrepreneur as well.
That's Kim Osorio, former editor-in-chief of The Source. Cypher.
What? Yeah.
Well, I have a question for you, too.
Yes.
Well, let's not forget this part.
Okay.
Reasonable Doubt came out on Rockefeller through Priority.
Yeah.
Volume 1 comes out on Rockefeller through Def Jam.
Yeah.
So what's the story of how he ended up, that him and Dame Dash ended up getting Rockefeller to Def Jam from Priority?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know 100%, but that's the story of the 900 grand. You ever heard that number before?
Yeah.
There's like, I think Priority was just, it wasn't, we're signing as an artist to your company. We're just, you're helping us put this record out. And maybe just this one, obviously. You know? And then he made a lot of noise and Def Jam came in and basically the lore, the legend is they walked into Def Jam and was like, we don't need any of your money. We don't need your money to produce videos. We don't need your money to go to the studio. We just need you to put our records on trucks and deliver them to the stores, like the distribution, right? So basically they said, like, we came in 900 grand. Like, we already have all the money that we need. We have more than you would give us to do this project. You know what I'm saying? So we don't need your money.
Do you remember him going to Def Jam?
I remember that story vaguely. So long ago, it feels like. But, you know, it's funny that when you think about it now and you would think about, like, how, you wonder if they really had that money, right, back then, or if it was all just, like, part of the perception. And they went in there like, yo, we got this already. And then they left the office and was like, yo.
Yeah, we pulled this off.
We pulled that shit off.
Well, yeah, because it's a great number. It's like, we don't. It's not a million. We're almost at a million.
Right.
But it sounds so good. And
we have 999 grand. You know what, though? I mean, who wouldn't want to be at Def Jam back then, right? Because Def Jam was like the source. That was where the legends in hip-hop were. Yeah. And I think that that was a big step. No disrespect to Priority. But, you know, Priority was like that independent label. What's the story? Is it Priority in the NWA movie that's putting out, like, the fucking raisins? Mm-hmm. Can I curse on here?
Sure.
Yeah. Like, they're putting out the raisins, right? Yeah. So, no. Like, no one is, like, aspiring to be at Priority back then. Yeah, like, no. No one really aspired to be at Priority. Like, although they were doing their thing on the independent tip.
Yeah, they had Masterpiece. They had No Limit, too. But, yeah, like, it wasn't really a label. They were just...
It wasn't like Def Jam was like... It's an iconic hip-hop label.
Well, at that moment, Def Jam has Redman, Method Man, LL, DMX. It was a good time for Def Jam.
Yeah, it's Def Jam.
Like, even before that, there were so many people.
Yeah. No, this is just in that moment.
Yeah. Slick Rick, Def Jam.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, so, they were loaded.
Yeah, they had the credibility. You know, the 90s is when hip hop really became mainstream, right? And so for Jay-Z to toe that line so elegantly was a big accomplishment for us in hip hop. Because we're like, look at what he's doing. We still respect it. Because you remember the day when you crossed over and you were whack?
Yes.
Remember that? That's like early 90s, right? Yep. Like, the whole thing is like, as soon as you got that hit record and you got on the charts, it was like, ah, you're whack. Young MC, bust a move.
Right.
You know,
we were very, very, it was rigid.
Right.
So a big part of establishing the entire Jay-Z Rockefeller brand was, of course, media presence.
Yeah.
But it's still the 90s. So, like, mainstream media is not giving that much love to hip hop yet.
That's where people don't realize, like, how common and how pop culture hip hop is today. And, like, every media company, any blog, any website, any magazine, hip hop is on the cover, just normal now. But it wasn't like that back then.
No. That's why at that time, The Source and XXL, these magazines, were so important, because they're some of the only national media covering hip hop seriously.
And is how I decorated my bedroom in those days. I needed those magazines.
Great point.
Yeah.
Rap Sheet, Rap Pages, Murder Dog, Ego Trip, The Source, XXL, Vibe, other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first thing? Do you remember what you first wrote about him or first interview you did with him or anything like that?
I don't know if... Did I interview Jay... I'm thinking I didn't interview him until after 2000, mm-hmm. right? I remember when he got didn't he do the first cover of XXL or something like that? It was like one of their early covers.
Okay.
Back then, you know, magazines were scared to take a chance on someone who had never had a cover before. So if you've never had the cover, that was like a big thing. Yeah, like, we can't just put somebody on the cover.
And getting your first cover for an artist is a big thing, too.
Right. And also, I think with The Source and XXL and Vibe, these magazines were able to cover artists that the mainstream publications at the time, Rolling Stone, they would not give Jay-Z a cover back then. Like, in the 90s, when he said, like, that wasn't enough for them. You had to sort of become this cultural phenomenon. Right. And I don't think that he was at that stage.
Do you remember the first thing you ever did related to Jay-Z?
Who?
Oh, man.
The rapper.
Oh, is this the guy we're doing the podcast about? Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Stay focused, man.
Yes.
Damn, the first thing? Yeah. Well, yeah, it was it was Double XL's first issue. And I remember James Bernard, that first issue in 97, it had a split cover. It was Jay-Z in a cigar spot, and the other cover was Master P. And they were saying that these were the guys that were going to carry hip-hop into its business culture, pretty much. Outside of just their rapping skill, this is what it is.
That's Daytuan Thomas, hip-hop journalist and editor-in-chief of Vibe magazine.
Years later, I actually did the Murder, Inc. cover with Jay-Z, DMX, and Ja Rule.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was incredible.
That was a good
one. It was supposed to come out as Murder, Inc.
You know? Now, okay, so look, he was trying to get radio, because that was basically the only way to get out there back
radio
in the day.
Radio. For losers.
And magazine publications.
Yeah,
something you're an expert at.
Yep.
How did the magazine world, this is pre-internet, pre-blogs, pre-everything, mm-hmm. how did the magazine world or the publications help push Jay-Z to that next level?
They really put his image out there beyond album covers. Beyond album covers and snipes. Album covers and snipes, that's your image. That's you promoting to get money.
Yeah.
With magazines, we're trying to promote to get money. So now it's like we're going to merge with whatever your look is, and we try to, you know, take you to that next stratosphere. And he used the magazines just as much as the magazines used him. And he even raps about it. Magazines know they put me on the cover because I earned for them. Like,
right.
He knew what he's like, yo, y'all don't love me.
Mm-hmm.
I just read a magazine article that fucked up my day. He really don't like magazines. At the end of the day, he hates interviews.
Right.
He doesn't really give you a lot of shit. For the Murder, Inc. joint, like, he answered two of my questions. And that wasn't during the interview. It was like, I had to really take in color around Jay. He had me everywhere with him. He was like, yo, come on. Yo, you ready for an interview? Nah, chill.
But hold on. You rolled with him
everywhere.
For a day. Or whatever.
More than a day. He shot three videos at the Warner lot. Jigga What, Jigga Who. Money Cash Hoes, and it was like a trailer for some other shit.
So this is all during Volume 2.
Yeah, and everybody was there. When I say everybody, he had the whole rock, I'm talking Jay Brown, Irv, Biggs, this was Bean's first time in Cali.
Yeah.
DMX, everybody is there? The Rangers were not there.
Forget it.
I got a story with them too.
Wait, so this was in Cali. You went to Cali for this.
For the Murder, Inc. cover. So that was like, I was jumping around. And then at the time, they were preparing for the, what was the 99 tour? Not that. Hard Knock Life tour. They were preparing for that. And I bring it up because, like, you have to realize, like, Jay has the whole label. Everybody's just looking towards him, man. Like, even when he's walking, it's like, people don't want to fuck with him, but they have to because they have to ask him a question.
That's the only chance they got.
That's the only chance they got. And then he was like, he would be like, damn, like, this is the story, not what I say.
Yeah.
I want you to see what I go through, basically. I went to like a birthday party for Brandy with him and shit, and I got to see how other celebs act towards him outside of it being like social media. Now we know what Jay is doing in the corner and shit. Imagine being at a star-studded event like that, and everybody is flocking towards Jay, and Jay's
even
like—
Even back then.
It was insane.
That's what I always try to tell. This is what I try to tell Rosenberg, because, you know, he wasn't living here at the time.
Right.
And, you know, he was like just a troll under a bridge in Maryland. And and I say, even back then, Jay had a presence, even though he wasn't as big as he is now, or even a couple years after that.
So this is 99.
98 going into 99.
98 going into 99.
Yeah.
We're still a couple of years away from the Blueprint, where he's at his complete total stride.
Yep.
But in hip hop and in the music world, you're saying he was already completely the man.
He was already the man, completely.
All right, so at this point, Jay-Z starts dropping. I mean, dropping music every year.
Yeah.
In 97, 98, and 99, he drops In My Lifetime Volume 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
They all go platinum.
Hello.
2 goes 5 times platinum.
Right.
And 3 goes 3 times platinum. He's also got massive hits, Hard Knock Life.
People call it the Annie song because it features the chorus from the Broadway show Annie, the little white girl that had adopted by a rich guy.
I think Telly Savalas was in that. or Yul Brynner, whatever, some bald white man. And Big Pimpin' with UGK, which was just an absolute smash.
Smash hit.
And it's a classic example of blending New York hip hop and the South perfectly.
Right.
It brought together Port Arthur, Texas's own UGK, their Southern bounce with New York vibes as well. And these records, like, they helped him cross over and go sort of mainstream.
Yeah, he was smart enough to know how to make dope music, but also how to use the music to manipulate the movement into the culture, into a more mainstream realm. Yeah. And then you go further down the line. When does Jay-Z cross over into that next stratosphere?
I think when he started working with like Timbaland and the rest of those guys, you start getting Lobster and Shrimp. And,
I was about to make a joke, so you're saying the moment was Lobster and Shrimp.
It's not that. It's when, you know, the Nutty Professor stuff and all of that, like you start seeing them on bigger platforms and stuff like that.
We didn't talk about that because Ain't No was put on Nutty Professor.
So that, what that did was that expanded the fan base. It's a huge ass movie with Eddie Murphy.
And Nutty Professor was Def Jam.
That was Def Jam all the way.
Ain't No was not.
Yeah.
It was still a way to get it on there. We are now in the end of the 1990s, the greatest era in hip hop to me. Now, this guy, Jay-Z, he's really, really, really starting to gain notoriety and respect. And most importantly, he's achieving incredible financial success. I don't know if you know what that means, Rosenberg. He's getting that money, the bags, the guap, the pay, the cheddar, the bread, the finances, the Fetty. All of that.
The Bunsen burner.
Little earner.
Nice little earner. Okay, so he's getting the success. He's getting the money. But here's the question I want to delve into.
Yeah.
When did he become part of the conversation about who's the greatest rapper of all time?
Well, you know what's funny? Listen, obviously we're doing this because we do believe.
Wait.
Okay.
Wait. Don't say it.
Okay. Why not?
Save it for the next episode.
What do you mean?
We're doing another one next week.
I have a great point that I have to make.
Okay, ready? I'm gonna say count to three, start your point, and engineer, when I get to three, hit stop on the recorder. Ready? One.
Wait, hold on.
Two,
if he hits stop,
three.
I won't be able to.
Go ahead, Syfe. One episode hosted by me, Peter Rosenberg.
And me, Cypher Sounds.
Our production team is associate producer Rob Dozier.
And production assistant Hebron Mendez.
Dan Panarese is our associate editor. Our executive producer is Chiquita Pascal.
Juan Epp is a production of Mass Appeal and Endeavor Audio and is also created by producer Samantha Allison of Endeavor Audio and associate producer Savannah Jeffries of Mass Appeal.
As well as executive producer Mark Grandy of Mass Appeal and Dave Easton of Endeavor Audio.
Cedric Wilson is our mix engineer.
Kasim Bradley is our recording engineer.
Special thank you to editorial board TK Dukes,
Gabby Bulgarelli,
and Mary Baxter.
I know them well. Make sure you subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review us.